Welcome to this beautiful, sunny Juneau afternoon. On this Friday, I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. We're going to get a preview today of this week's Friday Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center about Taku, the Juneau Icefield's only advancing glacier. We're also going to be finding out about this Saturday's Rotary Food Drive. We're going to learn about a follow-up community conversation about the recent play, Wrestling Jerusalem. And we'll get an update about Perseverance Theater's current production, In the Next Room, or the Vibrator Play. Also, it's going to be a packed show. We're going to learn about the Southeast Alaska Home and Outdoor Living Expo. So much coming up this weekend and so many great things to do here in Juneau on this beautiful sunny day. Looks like it's going to get a little cloudy tomorrow, so get your outdoor activities in now. And now first, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Flagstaff City Council this week delayed a vote on a settlement with the Hopi tribe and the long-running lawsuit over snowmaking on the San Francisco Peaks. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
The settlement would require the city to build $1.5 million earthen filtration system to further treat reclaimed water used for snowmaking at Arizona Snow Bowl. Navajo President Russell Begay and Council Speaker Lorenzo Bates, however, say they weren't consulted about the agreement, and the use of reclaimed water on the peaks is a violation of the tribe's religious rights. More than a dozen southwestern tribes consider the San Francisco Peaks sacred and oppose snowmaking there. The Hopi tribe sued the city of Flagstaff in 2011 over the sale of reclaimed water for snowmaking and said it was a public nuisance. Arizona Snow Bowl began using reclaimed water in 2012 to expand its ski season and can buy up to 1.5 million gallons per day between November and February. If the agreement between the city and the Hopi tribe is finalized, the new filtration system would go into use in 2017. I'm Ryan Heiches in Flagstaff.
The National Congress of American Indians praises the pledge by President Obama and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to fight climate change. NCAI calls this week's meeting between the leaders historic. Obama says his administration plans to work with Native communities to come up with a sustainable Arctic economic plan. Indigenous leaders from both countries were invited to the White House to take part in an event to welcome the Prime Minister. Two Native American high school girls basketball teams played in the New Mexico State Championship semifinals against each other Thursday in Albuquerque. The Class 4A Lady Chieftains from the Navajo community of Shiprock and the Lady Braves from Santa Fe Indian School. Native pride was part of the game from the start. Junior ROTC students from Shiprock kicked off the event by posting colors. The national anthem was then presented in Navajo by Julia Redhouse. Players from both schools say their Native American heritage is shown on and off the court and includes being a role model for girls in their communities.
My family has always like preached to me that since all of them went to the Indian school, they're like, you should be proud to be a Lady Brave because Lady Braves basketball is legendary and we just need to keep it going.
I would say the biggest thing is, like, my sisters have always told me, like, you're not doing this for yourself. Or even my mom, even her, you're not doing this for yourself. You're not doing it for your family. You know, you're not doing it, like, just for your extended family in general. You're doing it for Indian country. And, I mean, so you're trying to set it up for all these little girls here who are sitting here looking for the same opportunity as us.
I think it's just, like, being able to grow up with it. You know, it sets your, like, mindset to be able to control it. And it trains yourself, so like you develop just a little bit of confidence.
But you're able to make it possible. You follow, chase your dreams, and it'll happen.
The Santa Fe Indian School team represents a number of different tribes, including Pueblos, Umatilla, and Mandan Hidatsa Narikara. Head coach Christy Abeda.
As Pueblo women, and I'm all my staff, and I'm so proud that I have all Pueblo women. We instill those cultural core values. We come with that, you know, we pray in our traditional way. We bring our culture into the court with us, and you anticipate these big games because you know what's at stake. It's not just the semifinals. It's pride. It's that sense of honor that we carry. It's huge, you know, played in the semifinals against another Indian team that was just amazing.
Support for both schools was shown by fans who cheered on the players at the game, which was dominated by the Lady Chieftains, who won 58-23. The Shiprock girls go on to compete for the state title today against Albuquerque's Hope Christian School. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Support by Vision Maker Media, whose mission is to empower and engage Native people to tell stories. On February 20th, Vision Maker Media celebrates 40 years of advancing Native culture, heritage, wisdom, sacred stories, and the storyteller. More at visionmakermedia.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Join the Alaskan Brew Crew at the Juneau Yacht Club Saturday, March 19th for the Love Boat Kicker Launch Party, a benefit for KXLL.
Playboy Spaceman will be there for live Love Boat music. There'll be giveaways, games, and we'll be sampling Alaskan's brand new beer, Kicker Session IPA.
That's live Love Boat with Playboy Spaceman and Alaskan Brewing on March 19th at 9 p.m. at the Yacht Club.
All for excellent radio and
for love.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. Pick, click, give. A great and easy way to support nonprofits in Alaska. You simply donate during your PFD application process. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through March 31st. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein, your host today, and I've been joined by Jason Amundson, who is a person who studies glaciers. You're an assistant professor out at UAS, and you've been researching the Juno ice field, I guess, in general, but very specifically the Taku Glacier.
That's right. We've got a project funded. It's actually been funded for a couple of years now to study the dynamics of the terminus of the Taku Glacier.
So it's such a fascinating different glacier, because unlike what we're hearing about so much, that glaciers are melting and glaciers are going away and they're receding, the Taku Glacier is actually advancing. So tell me a little bit about how that can occur.
Yeah, well, so Taku is it's basically a tidewater glacier. It's not calving icebergs at the moment, but we would say it's in the advanced phase of the tidewater glacier cycle. And tidewater glaciers are special because they can go through this advance and retreat basically independent of climate, or at least the sensitivity of the glacier to climate changes with time.
What does the name tidewater glacier come from?
That it terminates in the ocean,
okay,
in tidewater.
Okay.
And so basically the way to think of it is that when a tidewater glacier starts to retreat, it can retreat too fast or too far, and so by the time it stops retreating, it might be out of sync with climate. So even though the climate might be warming, like we see happening now, the accumulation area of the glacier is really large, and so the glacier is going to start to advance.
When I think about the glaciers, and especially when you look from the air at glaciers, especially, to me, you can really see how they're just rivers. You know, they're fluid, really. They're slowly fluid, but they're fluid. So I had never heard of this phenomena that it almost sounds like you're describing a wave type of thing,
it's an oscillation, but I don't know if a wave is quite the right term.
Right.
Or not. But thinking of it as a river is actually not a bad idea either, because what happens and what we see at Taku is as it's flowing into the ocean, it's building up a big pile of sediment and moraine at the terminus, and that sediment actually limits how fast the glacier can flow. And so if you didn't have that sediment, the glacier would flow fast and the surface elevation of the glacier would be low. But that pile of sediment is preventing the ice from flowing out to the sea. And so the upper parts of the glacier will get thicker over time.
So almost damming it up in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you can think of that moraine as being a dam, and that's helping it to advance.
Huh.
And as it advances, it's deforming and pushing that sediment at the same time. So it's a coupled system and kind of tricky to think about.
Yeah. Is it still losing mass? Is it still losing volume?
It's not. So Taku was gaining mass or volume. It's not clear at the moment what's happened the last few years. I think it's possible that it's starting to transition over to losing mass. I think the jury's out on that a bit. It's certainly advanced a fair bit the last couple of years, so I would
Is there a typical, when you say there's an oscillation and we're talking about glaciers, is there a typical time period that you deal with in an oscillation? Is it, you know, is it's a seven-year thing, or is it?
No, well, it's, when you think about the tidewater glacier cycle, the retreat phase lasts something like 100 years.
Oh, 7 years was way off.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the glacier would be, a great example is Columbia Glacier. It was advanced really far down its fjord in, it must have been around 1980. Then it started to retreat. Since then, it's retreated, I don't know, 15, 20 miles or something like that. And it looks like it's going to retreat for another 30, 40 years. At some point, it'll basically retreat out of the water. And at that point, the retreat would slow down. So the retreat happens really quick. Well, I would say really quickly, like 50 to 100 years, whereas the advance phase tends to last much longer.
What is that thing that triggers the back and forth? Is that part of what you're trying to study?
That's part of what we're trying to study. So the other sort of studies that I'm involved in are focused on the tidewater glaciers that are retreating. And so there we try to understand what drives iceberg calving. Submarine melting of the terminus seems to be pretty important as well. So the relatively warm ocean water eats away at the glacier ice. We don't understand that process very well either.
What are some theories, that you might have or that you're sort of working on or developing as far as, you said a couple of really interesting things there. One was sometimes the glacier advances too far, like basically these tidewater glaciers, when they start advancing, they advance too far.
Yeah.
So, why is that? Why do they start advancing so far? I'm sure that's part of what you're trying to study.
Yeah,
but
so what's initiates the retreat is difficult to say. Sometimes it could be climate, that you change the climate enough so that it starts to retreat. And then the big thing there is the geometry of the glacier. So when the tidewater glacier starts to retreat, it often will retreat into deeper water, meaning that the terminus is actually, like it might have been sitting on top of a shoal. And you see this in a lot of fjords around Alaska, that when you first go into the fjord, there's a really shallow shoal, some cases just, maybe 30 feet down or something like that. And then as you go farther into the fjord, the water gets really deep. So when the ice retreats back off of that shallow point, there's some feedbacks that occur just related to ice dynamics and the geometry, and it's really hard to stop a glacier from retreating once it gets into deep water.
Wow, it's fascinating to think about how they're sort of these living, you see them calve, and you see, of course, any of us who've been in Juneau and just have visited Mendenhall Glacier for the past, say, 20 years, you've noticed the dramatic difference. But the idea that they have this cyclical ebb and flow is very interesting.
Yeah.
Is it anticipated that all these glaciers that are now retreating will at some point all begin advancing again?
If the climate wasn't warming, then yeah. And one thing we see, so the advance phase lasts much longer. So you would expect that if the climate was steady, and you looked at all the tidewater glaciers in Alaska, that you would guess that like 90% of them should be advancing all the time, because the advance phase lasts so much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what we see. Instead, we see basically the opposite. There are a handful of other tidewater glaciers that are advancing, but most of them are retreating. And so that tells you that you can't, when you talk about tidewater glaciers, you can't ignore climate either. And if the climate keeps warming and they're not, they might just retreat up onto land and no longer be tidewater glaciers.
Right. And then the other question I had was, since we're having this global warming trend happening, and for the Taku Glacier especially, it's still advancing, is that like a danger point for the Taku Glacier in a way? Because it's expending its resources to advance out, and at the same time getting this pressure of warmer weather?
Yeah, so that could... That was one of the ideas I was trying to allude to earlier. So as the glacier advances, what happens is the ablation area, the part of the glacier that is, overall is melting from one year to the next. So when you go there in the summertime, there's no snow left over. That part of the glacier is going to get bigger just because the glacier is getting longer.
Mm-hmm.
And you have more of the glacier at low elevation. And then if that also happens at the same time that air temperatures are going up or precipitation is decreasing, if either of those things happened, then the glacier would become more sensitive to climate, and then it could start to retreat back into deep water.
Mm. Yeah, well, such fascinating stuff. I really appreciate you taking the time to explain it to us. And you're going to be doing two talks tonight out at the glacier, at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, about the Taku Glacier. It's at 6:30 and 8 p.m. And what are you hoping that people come away with from the talks you give tonight?
That's a good question. I guess just an appreciation for how quickly glaciers can change and how quickly the landscape around them can change. And also, and you know, we're familiar with that looking at Mendenhall, because you can go and find photos where you are looking at the glacier and 20 or 50 years later, there's a photo from the same spot and you just see forest.
Here,
at Taku, we can watch trees getting run over, sediment getting deformed, and so it's a different process. But we have time-lapse videos that we'll be showing of these sorts of things happening. And
which is a fascinating thing, though. I mean, we could watch those over and over again just to see how, in that sort of quicker time, how alive they are.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's what I hope people take away, is appreciation for how dynamic that environment is.
Well, great. Are you giving the talk alone, or are you giving it?
I'll be giving it with Martin Schroefer. He's a professor up in Fairbanks. He's my graduate advisor, and I've continued working with him through the years.
Great. So Martin and Jason will be there talking about Taku. It's at 6:30 and 8 o'clock. It's happening tonight, and it's all about the Taku Glacier, the Juneau Icefield's only advancing glacier. Jason, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate you letting us know about this. It's fascinating, and I'm sure you're going to get lots of people there tonight, enthralled with what you're talking about. Thanks again.
Yep.
Afternoon, Andy Klein with you, and joining me next is to talk about the Rotary Food Drive coming up this Saturday is Lance Walters from Rotary and Darren Adams from the Southeast Alaska Food Bank. Thanks to both of you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Big weekend ahead here for you. Big Saturday coming up.
Yes. It should be a busy weekend.
So what is this? Is this a tradition? Many years have been doing this?
We were just talking about it out in the waiting room, and we're trying to figure out how many years it has been, and Darren was saying at least 11 years that he's been with the food bank.
Yeah, I've been at the food bank since 2005, and it seems to be a yearly event.
Yeah, that's great. And so what's the typical day look like for you? What happens?
Well, the Rotary is generous enough to man several grocery stores around town. This year, I believe you're at 4 stores, and they'll be at the stores soliciting donations as people come in and then collecting those donations as people check out and exit the building. And then all those donations are being loaded onto various school buses that First Student is loaning us for the day, and those buses will transport the donations out to the food bank, where we'll be unloading them on Sunday.
Great. So what kind of stuff are you hoping people
Well,
bring?
Darren,
I'm
Darren,
sure there's a good list here of stuff to...
There is, and everybody that is willing to take one of these little bookmarks that Darren has given us have some, just things that are just important essentials, like canned vegetables and fruit, peanut butter, canned meats like tuna or chicken, rice, canned beans, pasta, soups. Yeah.
You know, pretty much anything that you would find in a grocery store that's non-perishable, we can accept.
Great.
Including cleaning supplies, toiletries, diapers, pet food. You know, about the only items I am not allowed to accept are homemade items and also outdated baby food. I'd also like to mention that this is an excellent way to do a little spring cleaning and clean out your pantry at home, figure out what you may have bought a case of at Costco that you can live without a few cans of, And also, you know, keep in mind that that item that's furthest back in your pantry that you will probably never get to could be someone's dinner.
Why is this such a good fit for Rotary to be a part of?
It's the Rotary. We do things in the community to make the community better. Feeding people is super important. It's not good for people to go hungry.
No, right. And Darren, I wanted to touch on that next. The need that's out there, are we at a bad time right now? Are we seeing a fairly acute need? What's going on in the community?
In a very interesting position right now. Walmart just closed up. They donated 23,000 pounds of food to us last year. Last year, we brought in just under 270,000 pounds of food, and we gave out about 250,000 pounds of food.
So not a big margin.
Yeah, there's not much margin. Now, the problem with Walmart closing is, on the one hand, we're losing approximately 8%, 9%, 10% of our donations. Plus now we're seeing roughly 100 to 150 employees who may or may not be unemployed now. So we're being hit in both directions that way. Just in general, though, from what I've seen, the economy is not doing that great. And, you know, with the cost of living, a lot of people might be having a tougher time just trying to get by.
Right.
And that's where we come in handy, and the partner agencies that we work with help fill in that gap.
Well, Lance, tell us one more time how people can get involved tomorrow, the hours, where to go, that sort of thing.
Well, there will be the three different Rotary clubs, including this year, Rotaract is manning out at Safeway, but we're going to be at IGA or Foodland. Super Bear, Fred Meyer, and then Safeway. People can come through 10 to 4, and we'll receive the donations of whatever it is that they're wanting to give. And, yeah.
And it's just a great reminder when you're there shopping and you see the folks at the front, maybe just pick up an extra couple of cans of something and drop it off on your way out.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, both IGA stores have put together donation bags where you can just go in, grab a bag that's already made up of items that we can use. They're either $10 or $20, and, you know, you don't even have to do any shopping other than just pay for the bag itself.
No, that's great. So it's happening tomorrow. It's Saturday's Rotary Food Drive at the four big grocery stores in town, Rotary and Rotaract manning it, and it's happening from 10 to 4 tomorrow.
Yeah, and if I could mention one more thing, on Sunday, if anyone wants to help unload the proceeds of this food drive, we're meeting up at the food bank at noon. Our address is 10020 Crazy Horse Drive, which is out near Don Abel. And it should take an hour, maybe 2 hours tops. But these events are always fun.
Yeah, many hands make light work. So,
exactly.
I could use as many people as possible out there. Well, great. Thanks so much to you, Darren Adams, and Lance Walters for coming in and letting us know about this. I'm sure you guys are going to have a great day tomorrow of bringing in the food and then, of course, unloading it on Sunday.
Yeah, and I'd just like to thank the community. We live in a very generous community, and the Rotary is very helpful.
Couldn't agree more. Thanks to both of you for coming in, and have a great food drive tomorrow.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Next, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Picture the stout, pointed bill of a kingfisher. Now, picture a high-speed passenger train in Japan, the front of its engine the railroad equivalent of that strong, stout beak. You've just imagined an example of biomimicry. In this case, when engineers solved a problem by imitating nature. The problem was one of physics. When a train with a rounded, bullet-shaped engine would enter a tunnel, the nose of the train would compress the air. When the train reached the end of the tunnel, the air would expand so rapidly that a tidal wave of air would pour forth, like a sonic boom. This tunnel boom could be heard far and wide. A little too far and wide. Now, it happened that the chief engineer for the West Japan Railway Company was a birder. and he'd seen kingfishers dive into water, creating hardly a splash. So, he and his team conducted various experiments until they created a shape that, when fitted on the front of the engine, would part the air rather than compress it. Today, trains in Japan are known not only for their speed, safety, and comfort, but also for their quietness. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for programming is provided in part by Karen Crane, candidate for Mayor of Juneau. Paid for by Crane for Mayor, 19191 Randall Road, Juneau, Alaska.
Support for this program comes from listeners like you and GCI, offering TurboZone in restaurants, coffee shops, sports arenas, and other locations. More information at GCI.com.
And welcome back to the studios here at KTO. I was so enthralled talking to our next guest here that I almost dropped the mic there for a second. But Ray Pastorino and KJ Metcalf have come in. Thanks to both of you for coming in. And I want to talk about the follow-up conversation that's going to be happening about this recent play that was just happening last weekend called Wrestling Jerusalem. So, KJ, I'll just turn to you first. Can you give a little, for those who aren't familiar with the play and the bringing of the play and all that to to Juno, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the play really came about as a result of a conflict that People for Peace and Justice, Juno People for Peace and Justice, had with the between themselves and the Jewish community. It was over the bombardment of Gaza, and JPPJ put an ad in the paper asking the U.S. government to stop funding the Israeli military and try and bring peace on both sides. And the Jewish community was upset by the ad and said, well, you don't understand. And so we started some dialogue. And out of that dialogue came the idea of bringing this play to Juno. And Natalie Rothaus had seen it in San Francisco and was so taken with it, she urged us to consider sponsoring it. So we got together. We did that. So it was a joint effort of the Perseverance Theater, Northern Light United Church, Sukkot Shalom, the Jewish synagogue, and Veterans for Peace also put some money in. And it came to this to Juno, and there were four performances, and it was one of the most amazing pieces of theater that I think I've ever seen. And it generated a lot of buzz in the community, a lot of conversation. So we thought, after each performance, there was a chance for some dialogue, and it just wasn't enough time. There was so much going on in the play that we thought, why not continue the conversation and see where it leads?
And Ray, you were likening it to group therapy to sort of get these discussions out in the open, to talk about them, and having the play be a catalyst for that. So can you tell me a little bit about what the play, what it sort of said to you and mm-hmm. and what it sort of elicited from you?
Well, the play is so complex and multifaceted. It speaks to you emotionally. It speaks to you intellectually. It hits you in many ways. It was a single actor portraying 17 different people, all with a variety of perspectives, feelings, opinions, experiences, some not so good, around the conflicts that occur over there, over the course of 85 minutes. And so as an audience member taking this in, you were struck in so many, many different ways, emotionally, like I said, intellectually, spiritually. There's a lot of spiritual content to it, because this is also the journey of Aaron
Davidman.
Davidman, his journey trying to sort this out. And it offered the audience a chance to just, in a reflective mode, take this in, experience it. And then we tried together to provide an opportunity for people to begin to discuss it and see what came up for them around it. And then hopefully to continue that discussion, because the conflicts there are reflective of so many conflicts we have within our own country and in our own communities. So we want to try and give this some traction and support it.
Did the play in some ways deepen commitment on both sides of the argument and in some ways allow people to see other sides of the argument? I mean, I'm wondering how, when you watch a play like this that deals directly with the issues that you're talking about, I can see watching something and going, yeah, exactly, right? You know, I agree with that. How did it bring the two groups closer to understanding?
Well, for myself, it allowed me to better see the other side and put a more human face to it and tell me that I needed to listen more carefully and understand the other side. I'm not sure that it changed any of my basic feelings about the conflict, but it made me want to sit down and talk about it in a more thoughtful way.
So this further discussion, tell me about how you see that kind of proceeding.
Well, initially, I think we want to just allow people to and support them and facilitate them continuing the discussion or the ability to process some things that perhaps they haven't had a chance to discuss or talk about since the performance. Some people were able to stay. Some, it was just emotionally overwhelming, and they left, but we're hoping we want to provide them with that opportunity. And I agree with KJ. The play produces a great opportunity to really learn to listen more and to see and reflect on not just how we're different from other people, but how in so very many ways we're similar, how we have and experience the same feelings, same needs and desires for peace and security and safety, all those things. And it sort of opened that up just a little bit more. And we're hoping just to be able to support people in discussing and exploring that together.
When people were discussing the play afterwards, and as you say, it was an emotional play, an emotional experience for people. Were there raw feelings? Or was it more of a intellectual conversation? How did people react to it?
Well, I'm sure there was a whole spectrum of reactions, but it was my sense that people were just awed by it. Mm-hmm. And that they could find parts that they identified with and parts that probably made them very uncomfortable.
If people want to, this is going to be happening, this next Continue the Conversation of Wrestling Jerusalem. It's happening Monday, March 14th from 7 to 8:30. It's going to be happening at the Jewish Temple, the Sukkot Shalom Temple. It's at 211 Cordova West Juneau. What if people want to be in the conversation but they haven't had a chance to see the play?
Well, we talked about that, and we think that it would be helpful for them to come and listen and get a sense of what the play was about. But it's so much bigger than that, because it's a way to begin to think about resolving issues or understanding issues in a different way. And the thing that amazed me is that it opened up my mind to the possibility of art in conflict resolution.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you talk about it. I didn't get a chance to see the play, but now I'm wishing I had.
I can loan you my copy of the script.
Well,
sometime.
There you go. It's the script. I mean, I'll bet maybe the script's out there somewhere online to read as well. But Wrestling Jerusalem, play by Aaron Davidman, is the topic of discussion, which is about this kind of bringing out more of a scope to the conflicts that have been happening. Continuing the conversation is happening Monday, March 14th. It's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. It's going to be happening at the Jewish Temple Sukkot Shalom, and that's at 211 Cordova. That's over in West Juneau. KJ Metcalf and Ray Pastorino, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. Have a great discussion on Monday. And,
all right.
And thanks so much for continuing to come in and tell us all about what you guys are always up to.
Okay.
Coming up next, here's Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 11th of March, 2016. It's the birthday of the poet who said, "Any time not spent on love is wasted." Torquato Tasso, born in Sorrento, Italy, 1544. Handsome, popular young man from a noble family. He wrote La Gerusalemme Liberata, Jerusalem Delivered, an epic poem about the Crusades. It was very popular across Europe, even as Tasso suffered from what is now thought to be schizophrenia, traveling incognito, paranoid around Europe, still writing love sonnets, plays, epic religious poems. The Pope proclaimed him poet laureate, but Tasso died just days before he was to be crowned in Rome. It was on this day, 1818, Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein was published. 2 years before, she had spent the summer in a cabin on Lake Geneva with her lover, Percy Shelley, her sister Claire, and Claire's lover, Lord Byron. It rained a lot, and one night Byron suggested that they all write ghost stories, and Mary imagined the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then on the working of some powerful engine, show signs of life and stir with an uneasy, half-vital motion, she wrote. So she set to work on it, Frankenstein. It's the birthday of the children's book author and illustrator Ezra Jack Keats, Brooklyn, 1916. He was the son of impoverished Jewish immigrants from Warsaw, wanted to be an artist, which worried his family, couldn't afford to go to art school, got a job painting murals for the Works Progress Administration, another job designing army camouflage in World War II, and started writing children's books. The Snowy Day was his first, done all in collage, about a young black boy named Peter playing in his neighborhood after a new snowfall, one of the first children's books to feature a black character. And it was on this day in 1918 the first cases of what would become the influenza pandemic were reported in the United States when 107 soldiers got sick at Fort Riley, Kansas. It was the worst pandemic in world history, the influenza of 1918, estimated that between 50 million and 100 million people died in just a few months, about 500,000 people in the United States. Here's a poem for today by Jean Nordhaus, With Their Wings, for Delia. On the evening you were born, after the tremendous churning that brought you forth, an owl flew onto the rail of the balcony where we sat, as darkness bled from backlit hills into the sky. In twilight, she perched on the ledge, measured us with wide, light-gleaming eyes, then sailed off on soft wings. Shades of my mother, I thought, half-believing the wide-set eyes and level gaze. For those who say the dead have no more truck with us are wrong. The dead are all around us, feathering the air with their wings. They see in the fertile darkness that surrounds this sack of light, and in these hours we call them back to steady us who live in time. A poem by Jean Nordhaus, With Their Wings, from her collection Memos from the Broken World, published by Mayapple Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Are the effects of shorter days and less light getting to you? Have you lost your motivation? Don't brush off that yearly feeling. It's simply a case of the winter blues that you have to tough out on your own. Take steps to keep your mood and motivation steady throughout the year by staying active. But if you find this isn't enough, talk with a professional. If you are struggling, search can help. Contact the search helpline at 877-294-0074.
That's an important message from Search, although today it's hard to have the winter blues as the light's getting a little bit brighter out there. And in fact, it's supposed to be mostly clear for the rest of the night, just maybe a little patchy fog late. And joining me is someone who is the weather's very important to, because Greg Stouffer, as a contractor, you've been telling me that we were just discussing how this crazy early spring-like weather is a boon for exterior work, especially construction.
Absolutely. I've got clients wanting to move projects up already.
Yeah, well, that's good, right?
It is good. Absolutely.
And Greg's here because of the Southeast Alaska Home and Outdoor Living Expo, which starts, I didn't realize it starts at 5 o'clock. We got to get through this interview quick.
Yeah. Starts at 5 o'clock tonight with the beer and wine tasting.
So tell me about that. What's the ticket price for the beer and wine tasting, and what happens there? There's some food as well.
There's some food. Tonight, to get in, $25, open to the public, 21 and over. Catered by Hangar at the Wharf. Beer and wine is provided by Odom Wine and Spirits. Not sure what they're going to have there, but it's always been really, really good.
Yeah, right.
We also have live music, minimum wage.
Okay.
We have a auction going on tonight, so we have these derby cars and a derby car track, official Boy Scout track set up there. So you can bid on these cars for the Sunday race. You get to see them run tonight, but we won't be timing them. So try to pick that fastest car, bid on it. If it's your car, you bring it Sunday, race it. We'll run them a little bit tonight. And the proceeds to that go to the Eagle River Boy Scout Camp.
Oh, very cool. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So the home show has just seemed to grow and grow and get more and more awesome and elaborate every year. Is that how you've seen it too?
Yeah, we're really trying. Definitely trying to get more involvement with the home show. The housing here in town is quite expensive, so... and that's what, CBIA is putting this on. It's a nonprofit organization. We started locally here in Juneau in 1977. It's a chartered under NAHB, National Association of Home Builders. And, we promote, advocate for responsible construction and development. Home ownership is really the foundation of the American dream, the foundation for family. 15% of the economy is housing.
Really? 15%?
15%. And that's a national number. And recently heard some state numbers that it's closer to 38% here in Alaska.
Wow, yeah.
The construction overall as far as our economy. So it's very important aspect of the economy. So
what's happening in town right now with construction? Is there a lot of new construction happening compared to other years?
There is more and more housing going in. Every year we had a little bit of a slowdown. It's hard to find land to build, but things are starting to kind of open back up in the city of Juneau and state, and they're starting to work with us a little bit. And that's part of what we do is advocate for that and policy and regulations locally, state, and then we've got the National Association of Home Builders on our side too, so we're looking at the regulations there.
Very cool. And so what are some of the cool featured things that you'd see at the home, at the Home Expo here when you go into Centennial? I always think that you walk into Centennial Hall during the Home Expo and you're like, where am I? Because it just is like a transformed space. There's all these structures and just all kinds of stuff going on.
Right. There's all kinds of stuff. This year we even brought in some heavy equipment. You can see it outside. The weather's going to be beautiful. We can be outside. We've got three excavators out there, a couple small ones, and a medium-sized excavator, some scissor lifts, and another man lift.
Get behind the wheel, dry it out a little. No, you can't.
Well,
what?
Is
that right?
The Tyler Rental donated, or is letting them borrow those for the weekend. They're going to be there as far, and also the operating engineers, local 302, Union will be here helping out with that. So it should be a lot of fun for kids of all sizes, big and small. I know
well,
I love
cool.
getting on an excavator.
Yeah. Every now and then a friend will rent one or something, and I get to go dig up a rock and try to. It's hard.
Yeah. You're not doing it every day. It's pretty tough.
A little herky-jerky with the thing. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So this year, our main big corporate sponsor for the home show is Chad Erickson State Farm. Some sponsors for the wine night as Alaska Escrow and Title Insurance Agency, Alaska Renovators, Alaska USA Mortgage, and Real Estate Services.
Very cool. Let's go through the different tickets. So if people want to go to that beer and wine tasting tonight, that's a $25 ticket. And then that ticket allows you to go to the home show for the rest of the weekend
For the rest
well.
Of the weekend. So, you know, you can come mingle tonight and then check it out and then come back Saturday or Sunday or both days and, you know, really get some information, especially, you know, Saturday and Sunday we have some seminars that are going on. So there's a lot of knowledge kind of go there. If you're new to renovation or building a house, you can talk to realtors, bankers, lenders, contractors, remodelers, and they can give you the information started on the right path to.
It can be really complex and complicated, especially if you've never kind of dealt with that. If you're not a builder yourself, or if you're not someone who does that kind of work yourself, it can be really intimidating to think about taking on a project, or especially a new home or a major addition or renovation to your existing home.
Right. There's a lot of moving parts there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you come down this weekend and you may want to spend more than a couple of days there just because, you know, you're going to want to talk to every aspect of that building industry.
And you were saying that so the one ticket tonight is $25. That gets you in the whole time. But if you just want to go Sunday or just Saturday or Sunday and Saturday, it's only
$6. $6.
So if you buy a ticket on Saturday for $6, you still get to go on Sunday for free afterwards. And then so one ticket, any one of the three tickets covers you all weekend or for the rest of the time.
Right, right. And Sunday's kind of our family day, we'll have that derby track open.
Cool.
So if you have derby cars, the official Boy Scout derby cars, bring them on down. You know, we'll weigh them, officially race them and time them. And, you know, I'm not sure what the prizes are.
Okay, yeah.
But there might be some prizes.
Well, just pride. I mean, just bragging rights.
Absolutely. Especially if you bought a high dollar one tonight.
That's right. All right. Well, it's the Southeast Alaska Home and Outdoor Living Expo. It starts tonight. 5 o'clock is when the beer and wine tasting starts, and with food also from the Hangar on the Wharf. So that stuff's always great. And then again, Saturday and Sunday, and tickets there are $6 a piece on either Saturday or Sunday, and it gets you in for the rest of the weekend. Greg, thanks so much, and have a great home show. I hope you don't have to spend the whole time inside. It's going to be beautiful out. Yeah,
I'm going to be on those excavators outside.
All right. Yeah, that's right. Absolutely right. Yeah. Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Ice Arena is open 7 days a week, offering drop-in open skating, hockey, and a variety of special events. We are the proud home of the Crimson Bears hockey team, youth, adult, hockey, and figure skating programs. More information at juno.org/parksrec/icerink or call 586-0410.
Coming up next, we've got a special treat, which is we're going to revisit one of the exceptional speeches, presentations, talks that happened in March mudrooms. And this is next one we're going to hear is an excerpt from the March show. The complete show is on Thursday, March 24th at 7 p.m. But this next excerpt here comes from someone who's near and dear to my heart, a good friend and a colleague of mine, Melissa Griffiths. She's going to be presenting here for the next few minutes. Enjoy. This is Mudrooms with Melissa Griffiths.
All right. Our last speaker tonight is Melissa Griffiths. Melissa is a lifelong West Coaster, minus a year abroad, who has completed her northward journey having found her home here in Juneau. She's held many jobs, but a passion for stories and pretty pictures led her to her recent roles as a reporter and currently an Alaska beer evangelist and a designer on the side. Her life revolves around her main living beings, husband Todd, dog Beau, and friends. Plus, she likes creating things. Despite what people may have heard, she's not really a public speaker and is nervous to come out from behind the newsprint. So let's be extra warm and welcoming to Melissa.
A lot of you might already know me, if not personally, then through my years working at the Juno Empire as Neighbors editor and a reporter. During that time, I usually told other people's stories. So every once in a while, though, I did tell one of my own. I talked about adopting my dog, Bo, from the Humane Society. And, you know, that one time I eloped. So this is kind of actually like the story that leads up to the elopement. So in July of 2014, so about a year and a half ago, I married Todd, and it was a great decision, excellent decision. But some of the decisions leading up to that, before we decided to elope, were not that great. When Todd and I first got involved, I wasn't exactly single. I was actually in the midst of a 2.5-year relationship. And, you know, it was, I guess, going sort of okay. Or not really. So we're going to call him Rex. That was Tom's idea. It rhymes with X. So Rex the X and I were dating. And so we had some differences. You know, there was a big age difference. We had some differences in opinions and experience and, you know, completely different existential philosophies. But we made a good go of it. And there was one thing, though, during our relationship that I was not open to, and that was non-monogamy. I was like, no, that just sounds like it's not going to go well. So it wasn't until our relationship was in sort of a deep rut, maybe more of a death spiral, that... So non-monogamy became a reality. And it kind of, to set the scene, it starts on New Year's Eve, 2014. So that's 7 months before I marry Todd, for the record. And so we have this kind of long-standing issue where he's always gone on the holidays, and on my favorite holidays. Like, he doesn't do... The 4th of July, it's too patriotic. He doesn't do Halloween. Too much mischief? Fun? I don't know. He did do Halloween one time. I gave him an out. I said, you don't have to go. I know you hate it. And he said, no, I'm going to go. And he was the Charlie Brown ghost, you know, with like a white sheet with two eye holes cut out. It works a lot better in comic strips than it does in real life. So we go out, and there are lots of people, and his eye holes are, like, here. And so I'm flitting about being a social butterfly, and he just unannounced disappears. And then he got mad at me because I didn't, like, follow him or something. But this is actually about New Year's. Also, not his favorite holiday. It's, you know, lots of people, revelry, things like that. So for the third year in a row, I am celebrating New Year's with nobody to kiss at midnight. And that's a bummer. But I was trying to revel responsibly. So I was at a party at a friend's house, and everything was going great. But then after that midnight champagne toast, everybody's like, hey, we're going downtown! And so I was like, okay, let's do that. Let's go downtown. And I did. And that night I cheated. And I wasn't really supposed to be that enthusiastic about that line. I'm going to be somber from I cheated. And it was not a good thing to do. But I cheated with the man who is now my husband, if that makes it a little bit better. I justified it because I justified it directly to Todd. Like, he was like, hey, don't you have a boyfriend? And I was like, hey, it's cool. Like, he's super into this whole, like, concept of, like, not being monogamous. And I had always said no, so it wasn't a thing. But then, you know, now all of a sudden it kind of was. But he didn't know yet. The thing was, I wanted to be with Todd
more. But I also wasn't ready to give up on the relationship I had with Rex. And so when Rex returned, I was like, hey, so what about if we did give that non-monogamy thing a try? And so some people do this non-monogamy thing. Dan Savage, he's a sex advice columnist, he calls it monogamish. And for people, it works. Just not all people. So there's some rules. One of them is like communication, trust. Broke that one before we started, but we had other rules that maybe we also broke. One of them was we didn't tell each other who we were seeing. And so I was seeing Todd, and Rex was seeing other people, and then we decided we would tell, and then that kind of put a rift in things, because I was only seeing Todd, and Rex wanted me to kind of see more people, and, you know, I didn't really try too hard at that. And then Rex, he was seeing a woman who lived a stone's throw away from my back door, and I mean literally a stone's throw. One time I was upset, and I may have actually thrown a rock. But we didn't have a rule about proximity or about throwing rocks. So, you know, knowing, and it kind of made things worse. And it just brought all of our issues into very sharp focus. So, you know, she did things for him that I couldn't do. And it's not like a sex thing, I don't think. It was more like she would wake up early and make coffee, and she liked doing dishes. And so, you know, I got to this point where, you know, he was kind of jealous, and I was kind of distant, and I was like, oh, maybe he'll just pick her. And oh, I'm supposed to stop, but I'm not quite done. So anyway, and I realized that I was having a lot of fun with Todd. It was just, we were laughing, we were happy, and there was just this easiness that I had almost forgotten could exist. But, you know, Rex and I still tried. And then I, like, botched this grand gesture on Valentine's Day that led to a grand blowout. And then we were like, okay, we'll still try. And so we took a break from non-monogamy to focus on us, and it didn't work. So in April of 2014, this was only a few months after that fateful New Year's Eve, we broke up. And there was some ugly crying. It was not like a smooth thing. And then there was a period of solitary mourning for me, and then I started dating Todd for real. And Rex and I tried to do the friends thing. It didn't really work that well. It was hard. And so I severed ties, and hopefully, I mean, I felt free, and hopefully he did too. And then I eloped. Hashtag married. That is actually how we announced it on Instagram. And, you know, for me, this is a really beautiful story. But it's not a complete story unless you know all those kind of messy details that led to where we are today. And, you know, after all, you know, none of us would be where we are today if it weren't for all of those decisions, good or bad, all of those relationships, all of that that came before.
That's Melissa Griffiths for during the March Mudrooms. And that complete show is going to be here on KTOO at 7 p.m. on Thursday night, March 24th. So you can hear not just that, but all the other folks that were in Mudrooms. That's the show for today for Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. Thanks so much for listening.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210A.